One of the advantages really of private investments is they seem to be very resilient to some of the macro shocks that are out there.
That's Jim Strang, Managing Director and Chairman of EMEA at Hamilton Lane. I often turn to Jim for his fresh, occasionally contrarian takes on the private equity industry.
Almost like the more the macro shocks appear on the horizon, people think, well, we're not going to do anything other than keep going.
Wherever you think the industry might be headed, Jim is liable to give you a data point that could reorient your thinking.
We know this asset class is actually very good at protecting value, where the world shakes and public market volatility spikes and all sorts of crazy things happen. The great thing about private markets is the only asset class in the world where the insiders make the liquidity decisions. And that resiliency against a bad liquidity decision is what you really pay for with private markets.
This habit of bucking conventional wisdom, whether he's taking the short view or the long view, is one reason I asked Jim to sit down for a conversation about the growth prospects of the industry.
It feels like a big old industry, so let's call it $6 trillion. But, you know, the public bond and equity market is something like $180 trillion. We're six, so we're tiny.
I'm Hugh MacArthur, head of Bain's Global Private Equity Practice, and this is Dry Powder. I'd like to begin by talking about kind of what's going on right now. From a macro perspective, this year is shaping up to be a bumpy ride.
There's a lot going on, but the big trends that drive private markets and the inertia within it seems to be very powerful. We see really no real slowdown in people's appetite for private market investments, be they credit or equity or venture or infrastructure, no matter what they may be. So the uncertainty seems to increase nervousness, but not to change the answer.
How do you think private equity firms will keep their deal economics and portfolios together?
Well, I think it will all clearly depend on the size of the shock. Most of them have been preparing for what they feel is going to be some kind of event, and their underwriting has taken that into account. The capital structures will need to be sufficiently robust to withstand whatever shock there is that comes to pass. It's going to be an imperative to have very timely interventions, and then I think critically have the resources and the capability to pivot quite rapidly away from growth strategy to more of a defensive mode around maintaining and conserving value while whatever it is that passes through.
In 2008, 2009, we had the worst economic meltdown for 75 years. What do you think private equity investors have learned specifically that they can apply this time around for the coming shock, whether it happens in 2020 or beyond?
Yeah, I think one of the things which is really interesting is what will the shock look like? Because last time around, we had a sort of a really short, sharp correction. And then we had, particularly in the US, the actions of the Fed meant that things recovered really quite quickly. What are we going to get this time? Is it going to be a V or a U or a goodness knows what else? And that will have a bit of an impact on what people do. The obvious challenge is, where do I feel my private portfolio is at? They will suddenly feel a little bit overallocated, could be a lot overallocated. So the question is, in that situation, what do you do next? You know, do you look to try and solve for that overallocation problem, which is ultimately what happened in the last downturn? Or do you ride with it and take a view that the value will recover? Last time around, when funds and general partners sold assets, they, you know, sold them at pretty attractive prices from the perspective of the buyer. So for me, that's going to be an interesting thing. What's the shape of this event? And will people react in the same way as they did last time, or will they take a more considered view to the situation?
Shocks aside, Jim, what is the outlook in Hamilton Lane's view for the private equity industry? Can it really maintain the kind of growth in assets under management, fundraising, investments that we've seen over the last decade for the next 5 to 10 years? Does it have that kind of legs?
I would absolutely say yes. The addressable market for private market investments is a very big market. There are tens of multiples of private companies relative to the number of public ones. Being a good Dry Powder subscriber, having listened to the last episode, what that told us was that the private equity share of M&A, if anything, is falling, not rising. So the question for me is not so much, will it grow? It's what will the growth look like? Will it grow by 50% in the next 10 years? Will it grow by 100? I mean, if it grows by 100 and public markets grow in a reasonable rate, I think Hamilton Lane data suggests that we could get up to something like $10 or $15 trillion. Now, if it does get to that, then what do you need to believe about what the industry looks like? So what do funds look like, and how many deals do they have to do, and what are the sizes of those deals, etc.? And when you start to sketch it out, you can see how you could get there. And so, I mean, I would be firmly of the belief that it's got a really pretty rosy future ahead of it. And And I hope I'm right.
I hope you're right as well. So I think we're not disinterested bystanders here. But it sounds like there are a lot of companies out there. It sounds like given the just sheer value of assets in the marketplace that a doubling or trebling or even more of the asset class is certainly possible. But what does that look like? Is this more of a retail market now? We see BlackRock getting into to private equity. We see Vanguard recently announcing they're getting into private equity with funds. What does that future actually look like in your mind?
Yeah, I think it's definitely that. Institutional asset allocation to private equity is still, it's a single digit number. It could move materially from where it stands. And that will be a combination of existing institutional investors allocating more and then just new entrants. And again, certainly from our perspective, we see any number of just new entrants to the asset class. And there's no shortage of those. Touched on the obvious one, which is the sort of untapped market, which is a more of a consumer based investor, such as a Fidelity or a Vanguard or somebody of that order. Building a structure which allows customers with very significantly smaller wealth than an institution access to the market. And that clearly is on its way. And if it's not here already, it's here imminently. And that, again, is a very big market. So expect that to come.
So we have a lot of allocation room with institutional investors. We have a large consumer market that may be interested in tapping into private equity. We have a lot of companies to be bought across different geographies. It sounds like there's plenty of room for growth. How do GPs maintain returns in that type of environment?
Yeah, well, that's a good, obvious and very good question. And
I'm very good at asking the obvious question, Jimmy. You notice that through the process here.
The imperative is they're going to have to continue to reinvent what they do. And to push the boundaries of their own capabilities ever further. You've seen some of that in recent years where GPs have become much more focused in what they do and don't do. So that the pure, you know, we just do deals approach has been replaced by, we have real areas where we feel conviction around the makeup and the structure of the industries to make investments in. And we have a real sense of how we create value. So the models of value creation, the repeatability of those models has become a lexicon that you hear the GPs adopting. And I think you're going to have to see more and more of that. So you'll see more and more specialization around sectors and strategies and models. And what the GPs will be trying to do is develop those capabilities to the next level and to also to some extent to expand them.
Absolutely. And how does this play out geographically? You know, the US is obviously a very deep market. It's about 50% of the entire buyout market. And Europe tends to be a little bit different, as you would know better than anybody else. There are fewer kind of star platform GPs out there. It's a more thinly traded market in the sense that the sponsor-to-sponsor market is a much higher percentage in Europe than it is in the US. So what's coming to market and how it's sold and when it's going to be sold is much more known and much more transparent in Europe. How do you think Europe evolves longer term along these dimensions versus someplace like the US?
The economic perimeter of Europe and America is broadly the same, but obviously Europe is a fragmented agglomeration of all the constituent countries, whereas US is one homogenous market. And you know what that's meant for Europe is you've got this sort of polarizing market where larger funds have been able to operate multinationally, and the smaller funds, which are often considerably smaller than similar funds in the States, tend to be stuck in individual countries and struggle to get out. So you've seen this sort of two-speed situation develop where multinational funds have really got quite considerably bigger. There's not been very many new entrants into that group. We need more funds to get into this category of large and scalable platform. And I think if you sort of wind the clock forward and think about, you know, Europe doubling in terms of aggregate capital that's being deployed, then something's got to give.
And do you think that's the way the world is going, Jim, in Europe or perhaps even the US, where the big are just simply going to get bigger and this is going to become a more concentrated industry? Or do you think that even amidst the demand for expertise and new types of models, that there's room for entrepreneurialism and first-time funds and the number of funds can still grow? We can have different horses for courses, as it were.
Yeah, I think some of it will come down to the needs of the customers, Hugh. If it's a sovereign entity, for instance, it's very large capital deployment over a very long-term time frame, and they would be in one bucket potentially. And there will be other investors who say, you know what, I'm not trying to deploy billions. I'm trying to deploy relatively small amounts of capital and I want absolute alpha. And therefore, I'm happy to walk the streets of Munich to find a 200 million euro pool of capital where I think the manager can deliver five times the return. That's what I'm looking for. So I think that there will always be a market for these smaller, more niche strategies, call it, and indeed for new funds to develop and to launch into those. But it would just be part of the market, and there'll be another part of the market looking for quite a different thing, which will be served by platforms which will continue to scale and to develop. And they won't all win. The best in class GPs have been remarkably resilient to maintaining performance as they scale. And that's been a real feather in their cap. They will have to continue to redouble their efforts to do that. And the question is, how many will be able to do that? How many will be able to deploy ever increasing amounts of capital and not suffer return erosion? And some will and some won't. And that will be a fascinating development to see how that plays out and what happens to those that don't quite make it.
On the next episode of Dry Powder, Jim Strang and I talk about evolving and fraying relationships of GPs and LPs.
You have to be basically all over your GPs, all over their portfolio, all the time.
If you don't want to miss future episodes of Dry Powder, subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may listen. I'm Hugh MacArthur. Thank you for listening.